It's time once again for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 5 years has shared with us her extensive research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative, executive, and judicial processes in America. And now, Mae Brussel.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California, July 26, 1976, and this is Dialogue Conspiracy number 227. I spoke at length last week on Dialogue Conspiracy about the kidnapping at Chowchilla, and the bulk of the program today, most of, will be on that case and the new developments and the way it's going. I just did want to make a few announcements before. I'm going up to a trial this coming Thursday, July 29th, of a very interesting case. I don't want to mention on the air who it is or make notice that we will be attending it. It's out of the area. It's an important case, and I believe it has to do with one of those many zombies that I've referred to before, a person using aliases, mind-controlled, involved in a murder, involved in the military. And the hearing, the second court hearing on this case, is going to be this coming Thursday. And if any of you researchers are interested in taking a field trip into possible conspiracies and to see how the court operates in these cases, you can reach me at home, telephone me at my home. I'm listed in the phone book, and maybe go up. Several of us are going up and attend this case and see for yourselves how some of this investigation has to be done by attending the actual court cases. I also want to say that I received a telephone call this week. Woke me up in the morning. It was Attorney General John Hill from Austin, Texas. He's the Attorney General of Texas, regarding the Howard Hughes estate. And hopefully next week I can speak at length some more on the state of affairs with the Hughes estate, because those of you who know my research and my writings know that I have felt that Howard Hughes died in 1971, and that was not Howard Hughes. It was buried in Houston, Texas in April of 1976. The interest of the estate involves three parties now that are fighting over the place of residence of where he legally died, where the estate and the money would go. The Las Vegas interests want to declare that as his home state because he was owning most of the state of Nevada. But, and if it went into probate in Nevada, there'd be no inheritance tax, so the people who would get any money from it all would get a large share because it was Nevada. The Los Angeles interests, where the aircraft factories were and the used tool company, the air manufacturing angle was, want the probate there and have control of the interest there, and then the state of California would get approximately $1 billion in taxes also. And then the Texas interests want to say that Howard Hughes' legal residence, because of the tool company and being buried in Texas, that this was his home. And these are the people that I'm working with, and Attorney General Hill feels that Howard Hughes has not been seen since 1957. He's working hard with the Mexican authorities. He knows that a name was forged when they entered Mexico just prior to the official declaration of death, that Howard Hughes died of neglect, and he hasn't been seen since 1957. So they say that he hasn't been of sound mind since he was actively interested in the tool company in the Texas area, and they want to claim that as his home state. His first wife was there, and he was married there. He's buried there. And in this struggle between the three forces, I feel that a lot of the truths will come out about the real Howard Hughes. And in assisting the Attorney General, I gave him a list of questions. There were six questions for them to investigate. And I just want to let you know that I'm doing a little homework and work in between Dialogue Conspiracy and keeping up with some very vital matters that affect our country. One of the questions I suggested he go into is how far back the forgeries go, because at the time of the TWA lawsuit, Howard Hughes' name was forged then. And it precedes the TWA suit and the manipulation of this body through entire secrecy. Then, indeed, his home would be Texas. Also, who was forging Howard Hughes' name during the TWA struggle? How come there was no power of attorney? And then check out the fingerprints, which I'm trying to get information from FBI Director Clarence Kelly. He refuses to divulge who received the fingerprints and who identified them and what document they compared them to. And then I suggested that the Attorney General of Texas go to the Boston Hospital records in 1966 and subpoena the medical records of Howard Hughes. He was taken on a train from Los Angeles to Boston with machine gun guards on the train guarding that particular body, and maybe the guns were necessary because Hughes actually wasn't even on that train or in a condition to be seen publicly by anybody. And the Boston medical records should be kept by a hospital. Compare them to the medical records, the blood tests of the condition of Howard Hughes prior to his death, and if there weren't medical records, why not? And then last, I gave him the name of Brooks Randall that I wrote about in my Playgirl articles, being a double of Hughes. And Jack Anderson wrote about him after Howard Hughes died. Locate Brooks Randall. I'm sure the state of Texas has enough subpoena power or investigative power to try and locate him. Make sure he's alive. If he's not alive, when did he die? If he is alive, when did he stop working for Howard Hughes? And where is he buried if he's dead? What are his distinguishing marks? And then, if necessary, exhume the body in Houston, Texas, and see if the marks are more peculiar to the Howard Hughes who had burn marks from accidents and physical marks from his surgery in Los Angeles in 1946 and earlier dental marks. Compare it to the Brooks Randall marks, and that's a little homework for the Attorney General in Texas, and I hope he proceeds along those lines. Last week, I talked at length about the Chowchilla kidnapping, the 26 children and their bus driver, and I suggested that there's a lot of reason to believe that this is a very, very big story. It could be the Watergate West. It could lead, possibly, to the Manson family, the creation of the Manson family, the masterminds behind the creation of the SLA, and the killings of various political or civil rights leaders would then connect. If we could break this story, we could link it to the political assassinations as far back as Washington, D.C., and certainly in Los Angeles, of Robert Kennedy. The news media has been told by the investigators now, as of this date, July 26, that there is a mastermind behind this and that these three young men did not evidently take this off themselves. The word mastermind is a breakthrough in research and political investigation because I've said all along that there were masterminds behind the Corona allegations up at Yuba City where 25 people were killed, or the case of John Frazier, who was charged with killing the Oda family, or the Manson family, the creation of the Manson family, and bringing Charles Watson into that, and the Edmund Kemper and the Herbert Mullen charges. They were charged with killing 8 people and 6 people in the San Jose murders. The Zodiac claimed 35 deaths in this area. And I know, as I said last week, that there was a mastermind and there was a woman involved in each one of these cases. And this week, just today, the investigators are saying, number one, there's a mastermind, and number two, there is a woman. And I have called various law enforcement people and needled them, all of them involved in this area, and I shall continue to do so. The California violences have not been investigated properly, and if any one of the cases breaks and is discovered for what it is, it may lead, not necessarily, but I think it could lead to links behind the techniques of masterminding these other cases of violence. The main purpose of government-funded experimentations in this kind of thing is to create an army in the future that can make wars and kill people and be killed without knowledge or conscience of their acts. Now, I didn't make that up. That's a quotation almost directly from the congressional records from a Dr. Delgado, who has been funded by Navy intelligence and by the Army to experiment so that we could have wars of the future, have robots. These are human beings who are turned into robots who can take off these acts without any knowledge of what they did or any conscience. And I seriously believe that a lot of these people involved are not even aware of how they were used by the masterminds. The health, education, and welfare, the Army, and the CIA have all created literally thousands of experiments upon persons. I've mentioned this before. This statement is confirmed finally by an actress, radio star Candy Jones, a former model, from the same Conover agency where Gerald Ford worked. And at that point, she was turned into a future CIA agent. Candy, I've mentioned her, is suing the CIA for sending her to an Oakland doctor. It was out in Oakland, California, where she was injected. It was in California where she was hypnotized. It was in California where her double was created, and she was given another name. and sent on her espionage way doing all of her nasty jobs. Her last interview was with Jimmy Hoffa, and then she was told to kill herself. And this is important because the news media is now saying that the young men are suicidal, that the Richard Schoenman brought in, who gave himself up last Friday, is suicidal. And he said, my brother's suicidal, and it should be, and maybe the Woods boy, and maybe they have been hypnotized to kill themselves. Another point is that Candy was hypnotized on the telephone to go down to Paradise Island and travel to a place that the people were well aware of, that she would dive under a coral reef and die. And she has said on the radio and in her book that you can be hypnotized by the same control agent on a telephone conversation. So these young men may call in for advice of where to give themselves up and be instructed to kill themselves. And we are prepared by the news media now that they're suicidal. I think it's interesting that there's been a search extended now to Martha's Vineyard, which there's an area there, 500-acre estate owned by Mr. Wood, the father of one of the suspects that's being sought in the Chowchilla case. If you look at your map of Martha's Vineyard in Edgartown, Massachusetts, you realize that the Chappaquiddick affair of Senator Ted Kennedy and the accident that took place in the summer of 69 was right at Martha's Vineyard right there. And this particular family not only owns a 100-acre estate here in California where a lot of action has taken place, but they own 500 acres in Martha's Vineyard, which is a large parcel considering how small the island is. So we get to, again, the Ted Kennedy story happening at Martha's Vineyard and at Edgartown, which is a close proximity. At best, it's a coincidence, but it's certainly something worth looking into. And there's a lot more to the Chowchilla affair than people really can visualize, and this is what I want to talk about again today. Incidentally, you can buy that book, The Control of Candy Jones, or get at the library. It's written by Donald Bain, B-A-I-N. Playboy Press, 1976. I want to read a quotation, a few paragraphs by Richard Sprague that are apropos to the Chowchilla case. Richard Sprague is one of the finest researchers into political assassinations in the United States. He began a long series of articles starting in May 1970 in Computers and Automation on the photographic evidence suppressed with regard to the John Kennedy assassination. Sprague has written many articles on the Watergate case and the takeover of the U.S. government by the military. And now Computer Automation has a smaller issue called Pursuit of Truth, which comes out monthly with articles specifically on the assassinations and conspiracies. And in this new issue in July of 1976, Richard Sprague writes an article called The Takeover of America, The Power Control Group, and How It Began. And I want to read you a section of that and then continue on the subject of the Chowchilla kidnapping, because this is a attitude that Sprague has now, which I was claiming a long time ago. Mind control is involved in these conspiracies, and now the best of the researchers is forced to admit that this is a very big factor, and I believe it'll be a big factor when we find these young people, and if they're killed, we won't get a chance to properly explore it. Richard Sprague wrote that the taking of America has been both simple and at the same time very complex. What was once the greatest democracy in the world has been taken over by a power control group without the knowledge of most American people or their congressional representatives or most of the rest of the world. The use of the two fiendishly clever stratagems was necessary in order to keep the fact that control was seized from being obvious to the people. The first method of keeping control was establishment media in the dissemination of both the truth and false information. The establishment media has blocked the truth, and they flood false information out so that people can absorb that and hang on to that as easy answers. The second way that they control, he said, is through a clandestine weapons and techniques that were developed during World War II and perfected during the Korean and Vietnam Wars. These techniques are so new and unusual as to be unbelievable for most citizens. Thus, the incredibility of such weapons as hypnosis, brainwashing, and programming of particular patsies for assassins became a psychological tool in the bag of techniques of the power control group. The average American has shrugged this off, that it's hardly possible. He said the use of such weapons, when coupled with a tremendous campaign through the controlled media, such as whitewashing any sign of conspiracy or disinformation being spread throughout the country, has successfully blocked any serious or official attempts to get at the truth. Unofficial investigators, such as ourselves, Dick Sprague, myself, and hundreds of others now, private researchers, and even congressional representatives, either are ridiculed or completely blocked by a power control group, and the media continues to suppress the information. Now, for the first week, there was suppression in the Chowchilla of any chance of a conspiracy. It was singled to a simple motive, a $5 million ransom. It was centering on three individuals, and the people at the rock quarry were not involved in this conspiracy at all. It just centered on three young people. They whitewashed any sign of conspiracy, and only this week have they come out to admit that there's a conspiracy. And while you watch the daily papers, and I'll read some of the news reports to you, some very interesting facts, such as where these young men work, and if you don't take 10 papers a day, maybe you didn't see it, that they happen to work for Stanford University, where possibly needed security clearance at the defense area there, and we'll go into that. I want to continue the conspiratorial angles of this, because maybe you're not thinking of those. The major media isn't carrying them yet. I mentioned last week the Zodiac killer had said the next time that he appears, he's going to make it look like there were accidents and that he wants children on school buses. And the Manson family had said they want to kidnap children and take them to the desert. But this week we've learned that this particular family, Mr. Woods, had a backyard not only with 100 acres but 100 cars and trucks. He had a car collection that included school buses, vans, fire engines, motorcycles, police motorcycles, old cabs, all kinds of cars and makes. And we have to ask ourselves how far this conspiracy is going to go, and could this possibly be a carpool used by larger sources? We have to keep this open, that it could possibly be a carpool for unavailable cars that can later be painted. These boys rented a place where they painted cars, they fixed over cars, and we have to ask what kind of a yard was this? Was this a simple hobby, or were cars provided for any other kind of operations? And the reason I was interested in the cars is that I remember distinctly when I read the book The Family by Ed Sanders, who wrote about the Charles Manson family, I had a lot of trouble accepting what he was writing in that book. And I've talked to Ed Sanders and I've corresponded with him, because the very important parts of his book, particularly the very beginning, he leaves out any hard evidence of who was behind Charles Watson and Charles Manson. And the biggest clue was their transportation. They're getting a school bus and a microbus, a Volkswagen microbus in the beginning, and turning it into a school bus. And I would say, if you don't know how he bought the bus, how he funded it, how he made payments, who paid for it, then you really don't know who's the mastermind behind the Manson. So not having the mastermind located and knowing that there's a carpool that has the potential of providing transportation, I went back to the book The Family that Ed Sanders wrote. And briefly, in case you haven't read it, I want to give you a description of Charlie Manson and his mobility, because when he got out of prison, he had a lot of mobility and he had a lot of help. It's not identical to, say, James Earl Ray after Martin Luther King, before Martin Luther King was killed, when he got out of the Missouri prison and spent up to $10,000-$15,000 and had cars and transportation and traveled several continents and was able to pick up money and people wherever he went. There's mobility and mastermind behind these single patsies. And in The Family, Ed Sanders talks about Charlie Manson leaving prison. He was in prison for 6 years and 9 months and came out with $35 and a suitcase of clothes. Went directly to Berkeley with a guitar, met a Mary Bruner, who was a college graduate from the University of Wisconsin, worked at the UC library, moved right in with her. It's a very interesting contact to make as soon as he's been in prison 6.5 years, to go right up to Berkeley, meet a college graduate, librarian, move in with her. He was a federal parolee and should have gainful employment. That's a condition of parole. It was said by Sanders that he may have played in a nightclub in North Beach. There's no proof of it. He said that he was offered a job in Canada to sing, but no links of who in Canada offered Charlie Manson from California a job to sing. He went out of the state several times to Washington, the state of Washington. He took another trip to the West Virginia, all the time with no gainful employment and a parole officer to check on him. He went to San Jose, where he met a minister named Dean Morehouse, M-O-R-E-H-O-U-S-E, and his wife. And it was this Reverend Morehouse who gave Charlie Manson in San Jose a piano, which he allegedly turned right in for a Volkswagen camper, a 61 Volkswagen microbus. Now, how long this carpool was operating in San Jose or at the Woods Estate, we're really not sure on those 100 acres. But Charlie Manson was violating, according to most parole regulations. He was traveling, had mobility, went out of the state several times, goes to a minister's location in San Jose, gets a camper. Now, this is the part of the Manson family that always caught my interest that Ed Sanders wrote about. On page 41, he says, "The Manson group was growing. There were too many to sleep, much less to grope with comfortably in a Volkswagen, and winter was oozing onward. So the opportunity arose to acquire a school bus for further travels. It was in Sacramento where they seemed to have traded the Volkswagen bus and the down payment for a yellow school bus. And then they removed the seats and they began their travels." Now, there's no proof that Charles Manson got that school bus in Sacramento. It'd be interesting to get the payment papers on that bus and the down payment papers and locate exactly, because Ed Sanders is writing a book on the family, and all he can say about the school bus is the opportunity arose. Well, the opportunity arose for Charles Manson to get a Volkswagen bus in San Jose. And even Manson may have been told where to go to make friends and not know who was behind the masterminding behind this operation. I don't believe for a minute that he knew any more than who to call or where to go. But it's very interesting that he's handed literally a Volkswagen bus that is turned into a yellow school bus. And then again, Ed Sanders says, as time oozed on, they put in an icebox, a stereo, and coffee table. And there was a lot of oozing that winter. Then Charles Manson moved his parole from the Sacramento-San Francisco area to L.A., but then he went back up to San Jose and Sacramento, then to Florida. But before going to Florida, which is quite a long ways from California for a man on parole who's been in prison for 6 years and 9 months, who now has a school bus, and we know the Volkswagen came from San Jose, before he goes to Florida, he has to stop at Universal Studios where he cuts a record, and then they go to Mojave Desert in Santa Barbara and Las Vegas, Nevada. They hit Las Vegas, Nevada for 4 days, then to Arizona, New Mexico, El Paso, Mississippi, Mobile, Alabama, back to Arizona. A lot of mobility, and then to Topanga Canyon, where I said that was a safe house at the Spahn Ranch. Backs up to the Krupp property, and there's another story in itself in the property that's owned by the German ammunition makers, Krupps. The Reverend Morehouse didn't sever his relationships with Charles Manson at that point. His daughter was with Manson. Manson then had moved in with the Beach Boys in Hollywood, Sunset Boulevard, with Dennis Wilson. And Morehouse, the Reverend, and I think this is very interesting because in the newspaper this week, I read that the Wood boy, I don't know whether his father or just the son, was selling a bus to a church group. They could have sold them to 100 church groups, but the church always comes in, and there's a long espionage record of the Reverends through the last period of the Cold War and funding for Reverends. The Reverend Morehouse moved down as a guest of Dennis Wilson, according to Ed Sanders, where he was employed by Charlie Manson and Mr. Wilson. And he became even more important because he not only provided the microbus, the Reverend Morehouse, but he brought with him a young man from Texas. And always these links of Texas to the various assassinations and the conspiracies, the secretary that accompanied Stephen Bingham, the case of the San Quentin Six, the day that George Jackson was killed, went right away to Texas. Thera Wheeler, involved in the SLA case, went to Texas. Charles Watson, who killed Sharon Tate and the five people in the house in LaBianca's, was brought from Texas. Morehouse brought a man from Texas named Brooks Poston, P-O-S-T-E-N, who forked over, this is the word Sanders used, to Manson his credit cards, cards that belonged to his mother that were used extensively for their travels and funding in 1968. So the money, the credit cards, were not stolen. They were brought from somebody in Texas who was a contact from Reverend Morehouse, who gave Charlie his first bus. And Tex Watson also was brought from Texas, like Poston, who made connections with the Manson family. And in those days, Charlie was a big shot living at Dennis Wilson's. So the microbus, we know, came from San Jose. We don't know where the school bus came from. And some good investigators, maybe people at KZAP listening to this show in this particular area, could do some private investigating work or get on this and find some way to go to the Department of Motor Vehicles in Sacramento and maybe do your own work, like doing the various court cases that you attend, listeners that go to these court cases, and help me out. Maybe you can find out about any insurance on this bus, the equipment, the payments, the purchase of this bus, and maybe this would be important for the law enforcement to put and come forward in this particular case and needle them, and you do your own work and calling and find out where the bus was actually purchased, and is there any chance that the school bus came from San Jose, because this would be an important point, being as there was a mastermind behind the one case, and they're admitting there was a mastermind behind this. I just can't say how important it is to go into this particular case. This Fred Nickerson Woods III owned the rock quarry where this large bus from the Palo Alto, the big van was buried there. They could have been a tomb for these 27 people. Three Navy surplus trucks were bought by these young people. $8,000 was paid. The Wednesday night before Richard Schoenman gave himself up, he gave himself up on Friday night, he was babysitting for a family in his area there down there in San Jose. Was he babysitting for money? If it's money they needed, they had put $8,000 into three Navy surplus buses, plus those were the getaway, plus the large towing of this van, and they had put maybe $10,000, $20,000. It hasn't been added up into this kidnapping case. So it's very funny that he'd be babysitting for dollars and dimes and putting $8,000 into three Navy surplus trucks. So again, we have to go into the funding of this operation and the mastermind. The property there had 100 cars and trucks, many of them lined up in rows, and many of them were in working order. Some weren't and some were. And how many could be called to duty? And was it a carpool? Will they bring in Mr. Fred Nickerson Woods III and ask him under sworn testimony if these cars were ever used, did they follow where they went, who bought them, and how come this bizarre estate had all of these cars on it? There were links. They collected police horses and put them out to pasture. They had police motorcycles on the property. They had links to the military and the surplus vans, and the family was closely linked to police and military at many levels. It's interesting that the young men were linked also to an office in Menlo Park and at Stanford University. And we have to go into this. James Schoenfeld, one of the boys, the brother who's still missing, sold his vehicles to church groups. And we have to find out again how long this has been going on. And James filed papers. He worked at the U.S. Geodetic Survey Office in Menlo Park. Geodetic Survey. And we have to find out what kind of work they did and how long he worked there. He, in quotes, filed papers as one of his jobs. This is at Menlo Park. It's a U.S. Find out if it's a government agency. Find out how much he worked in what department. If it's a dummy front like McCord Associates or Emeritus at the Watergate or the polling survey office that Emily Harris worked at UC Berkeley. We have to check out the U.S. Geodetic Survey in the next week or two and find out what kind of an office that is. And Richard Schoenman worked at the Linear Accelerator at Stanford University. Now, Stanford University has been named by Don Fried and various researchers into the SLA, training Colson Westbrook, sending in mind control experimentation into Vacaville, and possibly working through the CIA. The Stanford Research Group has been linked to Vacaville and mind control experimentations. And it'll be interesting to know this Richard Schoenman now. He worked at the Linear Accelerator at Stanford University. How long did he work there? They said odd jobs. Was it a source of contacts? Remember, Lee Harvey Oswald in the Dallas, Texas area worked at a photographic lab, but he had been 60 times to an office, the Saul Bloom agency, that decided the motorcade that John Kennedy was going to take. What kind of odd jobs did this Richard Schoenman do at the Linear Accelerator at Stanford is a terribly important question. And what did Jim do at the Geodetic Survey Office, the U.S. office? Did they work for the government? Did they have security clearances? See, when you think where they work, it takes on more importance because the control men, the masterminders, could have worked through these offices. We don't know who they are yet. Maybe we'll know next week, but we have to find this out. And Frederick Newhall Woods, as I say, owned the rock quarry. We learned this this week. It was interesting when the children dug themselves out, and a boy aged 9 squeezed out through the hole and ran for help. He went not far away and saw a night watchman at the rock quarry. And the night watchman had already heard about the case, and he was the one who called the police. But will anybody at the quarry be charged for aiding and abetting this conspiracy? Will anyone there be charged, or do these connections just fade away as in all the other cases? The support, the tactical support, is what fades away in all these cases. There are links, as I say, to the military, to the police. These people seem to work in this kind of an operation where they bought Navy surplus buses. They knew where to go. They put the old police horses, as I say, to pasture. Their 3 vans came from Navy surplus. Neighbors that interviewed the children or the young men arrested, James Schoenfeld, claimed that he took their cars and went to government auctions and bought them, and they used these. They also talked about police motorcycles. There was talk about Jim buying police motorcycles and getting rid of them that he buys at San Jose auctions. And I know a particular man who was friendly with members of the Manson family who lived here in Carmel Valley, and he had several cars that duplicated each other. They were identical pairs, 2 station wagons, 2 Cadillacs, 2 motorcycles. What kind of pools do these people buy from? Can they buy duplicates of what they have for their doubles to continue espionage operations? Because there's double cars that look alike. There's double people in almost every one of these conspiracies that I've studied. And where do these cars come from? And if this carpool has police motorcycles that they buy at auctions and government auctions for automobiles and Navy surplus buses, and they have contacts with U.S. agencies, how much does this overlap to those people that they're calling the masterminds? And are we going to find this out or not? Or are these people going to be killed like the SLA? Now, the identification of the men last week was all off. They brought in 3 young men in the last week since I was on KLRB, and they didn't fit the description that the people had in the school bus. 26 of the children were on the bus, and at least 10 or 12 of them were old enough to make some identification, and certainly the bus driver, who never was blindfolded. And they had a man 45 or 36 with black curly hair. He had a chipped front tooth, a tattoo on his right arm, and sideburns. Another man was approximately 27 with brown hair and blue eyes. He had a mustache and goatee. You could easily cut those off, but the drawings of the men did not have that at the time that they were seen. They had no mustache or goatee. He had a mole on his chin and a possible French accent with lengthy brown hair. And the third man was 50 years old, 6 foot or feet or taller, with gray hair and an eagle tattoo on his right arm. The law enforcement are admitting this week that there is a difference of description. They're apologizing a little bit that the people that they've put out to find don't fit the physical description, but they give an excuse. We have a reason, but we can't tell you. It'll be interesting to see. Last week we got a description of young men that are the named suspects with the arrest warrants, and then we have totally different description of 3 people that the children and the bus driver saw. Now, the traces, FBI is saying in this morning's paper that they didn't do a very good job because they left traces behind and they were found. Well, maybe these people were meant to be found, and the masterminds will not be found so easily. As I say, there's a quotation in the San Francisco Chronicle this week that James Schoenfeld got a school bus. He sold bus to a church group. The church group came to my mind with the Manson getting the Volkswagen bus. And I think the funding of church groups as intelligence operations is so well documented now that we have to go into the funding of this operation and who was putting the money up for it. And we get to a very dangerous area here of a possible discrepancy of what's happening to the one suspect. We're already prepared for the fact that he could die, that he's suicidal. And this is to make ready in case maybe the two are killed, he will be found dead. And also, there may be a method of controlling this person. The paper this Sunday said, under the hospital cell, top lead article, it says, Richard Schoenfeld was moved to a hospital cell where he could be easily observed. And they went on to say that he suddenly became suicidal. Now, this is totally against his nature, his personality. At any time that he was growing up, people said the Schoenfeld boys were friendly, they were outgoing, and they fixed the fences, and they babysat for everybody. And there was nothing suicidal in their personalities any more than there was in Candy Jones' personality until she was told to commit suicide. So being as these experiences are becoming documented and even being named in lawsuits, keep them in mind. Because one wire service, AP wire service, tells us on one day that Richard Schoenfeld, after he surrendered Friday, was described by his attorney as being suicidal, that he fears for his brother, and his brother's in the same frame of mind that he is, that he's bewildered and frightened. And this is the attorney saying he's a really a nervous, baby-faced boy. The women's liberation wouldn't allow you to say it's a baby-faced girl if it's a 22-year-old. They get very angry. They call them women. So men's liberation should come out and say this isn't a boy. This is a man. They're trying to play it down that, you know, he left a lot of evidence, and he's very confused, and he's a baby-faced boy, and that he's suicidal, and they moved him to a hospital cell where he's easily observed. And then if you take another paper, the same wire service, the same day, it says Mr. Schoenfeld's first night in jail is described by the jailers as being peaceful and uneventful. He had a good breakfast. He had nothing to say. He wouldn't allow his picture to be taken, but he was doing very well. And this morning I read that they moved him into an open cell away from isolation, and he's next to Eldridge Cleaver, a well-known political prisoner, and that they are nearby and that he should be back in the mainstream of the population. So you have several versions of it. He's flying high and he's doing great, or he's in a hospital and he's suicidal, and so that anything can happen to this person. And I think it's interesting to note that the attorney that's speaking for him, who is on television, who seems very relaxed, and is speaking out for the one suspect who gave himself up, this Richard Schoenfeld, happens to be the same attorney who worked for Joseph Romero of the SLA, because I have believed all along that the SLA was an operation masterminded by quite a few people, and the framework of it, and it can be documented, was the CIA and the FBI behind that operation. And I think it's interesting that Edward Merrill, the office defending this particular case of Mr. Schoenfeld, is the SLA. You get a lot of overlappings here with Martha's Vineyard, the SLA, the buses from San Jose, the school buses, the ministers. You see, there's a bigger story here, and I'm just naming a few things which come to my mind for you to watch as it unfolds, because some of it may be suppressed, because the media does not use the information of the researchers very often. They keep every day throwing out a news story and refuse to look at the links. But the advantage of sharing this with you on the air is that I'm sure that not only people who are interested in following me every week are listening, but I'm sure that the powers that be have taped these shows for many, many weeks. And between needling the police departments and their knowing that they're being publicly exposed on the air, they're not in a position to cover it up as much as they used to. Since Watergate, there's been a big change, and a lot of investigations are taking place that never would have been possible after Watergate, and I felt that the arrest there would be beneficial in all kinds of investigations that aren't coming out fast enough, but they're coming along. And I think the powers that be are vulnerable. They can get fired. They can get exposed. They can lose their jobs, and there's going to be less likelihood to conceal if it's, you know, if it's possible, they'll let out more information, just as they're admitting at this stage. To say there's a mastermind here is about the greatest admission of the powers that be who control these situations that I've seen for a long time. Now, in all these cases I mentioned last week, the Dr. Oda case or Edmund Kemper or Mullen, these various cases, the Zodiac and the Sharon Tate murders, the Manson family things, there's women behind these cases. As a matter of fact, there's an interview that Timothy Leary did with Charles Manson, And Manson, it was in Playboy just last month, and he was saying that women were the cause of his downfall and that they were the ones that got him into trouble. And that's true, because I could outline about six women that really led Charlie from the time he made the very first contacts up out of prison into the Berkeley area until when he tried to appeal his trial, and just at the time he wants to appeal it on some very good evidence that he wasn't in the homes, just when he wants a chance for other hearings, along comes Sandra Good or Sweaky Fromm and says, I wanted to kill Ford because I wanted to call attention to Manson. Well, that doesn't help Charles Manson. That's just making sure that he never gets parole. It only can hurt Charles Manson. And there's no proof that he asked Sweaky to do those things. And Manson's blaming women. And all of these cases, as I said, I mentioned last week, there were women. And there was a woman who called the Chowchilla mayor and said that there's more to come. When they found the children, she says, well, don't worry, there's more to come. And that's true. And there was the story of the Woods boy who was living with a woman, or married or temporary with her, who it was a teenage marriage, who spent the last year of high school as a ward of the state, of the county foster home. Well, it would be interesting to get her name. She's a ward of the state. Could she be programmed or in any way used or influence Woods' life in some of the activity that went on? If the state has her, she's at Vacaville, or the women's prisons, she's not at Vacaville, but Tuscadero, or the women's prisons, or the homes where they can carry on. Can they do to her what they did to Sandra Good? Can you take an orphan or somebody who is the ward of a state, a juvenile, and mentally control them to lead these men? So as long as she's a ward of the state, what's her name, and who is the woman who was with the Woods boy? And the second marriage was to a woman of an interesting name, Song Gell Faye Paget. And she comes from Georgia, and Georgia links in, the state of Georgia is where the martial law plan was made that links to the California violences that Richard Nixon's new successor was supposed to be, Ronald Reagan. We'll see if he gets in. We've heard about the Garden Plot. The headquarters were in Georgia. And Georgia is one state that links maybe 8 or 10 times, like Texas, a modus operandi through the state of Georgia. And it's interesting that the second wife of the Woods boy lives in Georgia. And what does she know about the carpool, about the 100-acre estate? All we hear from her is she's saying is Woods is a person who is unloved at home. But what went on at the home? How did the girl from Georgia meet this Woods boy? How long were they married? Did they meet in Georgia? Did she live there? Did she know what went on at the States? It's the same man who owns a rock quarry. What was her role? Did she have a role? Is she a woman just like this one who's a ward of the state? How much control does Woods have his own mind? As I say, there was a woman who made an anonymous phone call. There's Manson who blames the women. The authorities have said this week that it today, as of today, that it does involve a woman. They said, we have no definite evidence, but a woman is involved, and I believe that's true. Now, the cover story, always the four false cover story, as soon as Fred Newhall Woods was named as a suspect, a wealthy family, a millionaire's son, described as a car buff, out comes that Lee Harvey Oswald loner story. Always the loner. Oswald was a loner. Arthur Bremer was a loner before he shot George Wallace, and Sirhan was a loner. And this is the easiest thing to say, that he had nothing to do with a life of crime. He was a loner. Intelligence agents are loners. Gary Powers, who flew the U-2, was described as a loner. Reinhard Gehlen, chief of Hitler's intelligence, described himself as a loner. Candy Jones, a CIA agent, was hypnotized and told to stay alone, told not to meet people, stay aloof from them, and be a loner. She was told to be a loner. We don't know if the Shonan boys are extroverts, if the Woods boy wasn't an extrovert. We don't know who the women were yet who were in his life, or if they had any part of it. As I say, the woman, the ward of the state, or Song Gell Faye Paget, we don't know what role they had. He's only described as a loner because we don't know who talked to him. We don't know who hypnotized him. We don't know anything about the boy. You can't be much of a loner and have two wives. At least he got married twice. And who are the families he married into? Who are these people around him? So that the quick motive is that they wanted $5 million. I don't believe that at all. And I don't believe the loner story. And I don't think that it will sell in Peoria this time. Now that there's masterminders, you had to meet with at least 3 or 4 other people and a woman and the 2 Shonan boys, so you can't be that much a loner. If you have 2 wives and 3 masterminders and 2 buddies, you have 5 close people right there. So it's obvious that the Woods boy isn't a loner in any sense of the word, and how in the world did he get into it? Now, there's a story that these three young men put up $40,000 to move a 19th-century home in Mountain View and needed $60,000 bond, and they could be influenced for the sake of having this big old 19th-century home to do something under the control of other people, and that would be a motive. Our time is up. I see 45 minutes are over, and I'll go into next week, hopefully some on the Howard Hughes story and some more on the Chowchilla, and let's hope that all these leads get pursued, because these are the story behind the story, and the masterminds, the women, the vehicles, and the California violences, and let's see how much of this comes together in the next week. I'll see you next week on Dialogue Conspiracy. Take care, and see you next Monday.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for many years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California.